Good morning and welcome to the Thursday, April 12th meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. The first item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes from yesterday, the Wednesday, April 11th meeting. Representative Pugh, have you had a chance to review those minutes and would you be willing to move them this morning for approval?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes for April the 11th.
Representative Pugh moves the committee minutes from April 11th. Any corrections? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Members, today we have the privilege of hearing from a number of the different councils and their activity reports from 2017 fiscal year. And I'm pleased to be able to have the members here. And we are going to start in this order, slightly different than the printed order. We'll start with the Asian Pacific Council, followed by the African American Heritage, and then followed by the Latino Affairs. So again, the order of presentations today for us will be the Asian Pacific, followed by African Heritage, and then the Latino Affairs. And if the representatives from the Asian Pacific Council are here, we'll ask them to come forward to the testifying table, and we'll be ready to hear from them. We are having a slight batting order change-up, so grab your scorecards. We are going to go with the We're going to go with the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. We'll go with those first. Megan's going to switch out the PowerPoints here for us. And as they're making their way to the testifying table... All set.
All right, Mr. Chair, thank you for having us this morning. We're excited.
Good morning. Yeah, if you will just go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the Executive Director for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. And with me I have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Nasser, for the record, N-A-S-S-E-R. Last name is M-U-S-S-A, Musa. And I'm the council's board chair.
Before we move on, members, in your packets there are some handouts that are here that I think will follow along with the presentation and help you to take a look at those. So I'll just draw your attention to that. I found three of them. Does that sound right?
Yes, that's
very good. Yep, thank you. If you'll proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. So for the most part, committee members, you can follow along with the PowerPoint handout. There is a copy of our report as well as a copy of our legislative agenda. But for this presentation, you can follow along with the PowerPoint handout that should have space for notes next to each slide.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and the committee members. I can see some familiar faces from my old days when I was a page here. I was one of those people who prepare test fires and making sure that we have everything in place. So this is good to be back. Again, my name is Nasser, so I'm the chair of the Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage. The Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage is about 38 years old agency, a little bit older than me. And as a state agency, with a focus on a few things, bridging the gap between the state government and African heritage communities through policy advocacy and advising elected officials, including governor and legislatures as well, on specific issues that affect the people of African heritage. The council has a responsibility, but with a specific focusing on advising a governor and legislature in serving as liaison on federal government, the state government, and also promoting the programs that help and address the issues that affect the people of African heritage. And also publishing the annual report with highlighting the contribution of the African heritage communities to the state of Minnesota economically, socially, and culturally. The council is nonpartisan policy platform. That's what I tell people all the time. The council is a policy platform where we provide people where to consult and address the issues that affect our communities. It was created in 1980 when the black population was only about 1% of the state population. So today we have 6% of African population in the state of Minnesota. So this population is continue growing gradually. I didn't say 60%, I said 6%. So the council members are very diverse and demographically very widely representative of the African heritage communities, including African immigrants, that includes myself, and also native-born African-Americans, those who reflect the demographic of African communities in the state. I believe this is a great platform, and I believe this is the council that is for the people, run by the people, and address issues in partnership with the government agencies, elected officials, and also community members as well. And I am always very appreciative of the board members who are serving on this council, as they come with really highly skilled in experience and expertise from very, very diverse background. And that really keeps me moving all the time forward. The 2017 was very transformative for for the council. The council used to be in downtown St. Paul, National Bank, the First National Bank. So we moved from there to the current location at the Centennial office building, which is walking distance from here, because it's really very difficult for us to commute between here and downtown St. Paul. That really did not serve the purpose very well, and we found ways to move closer to the capital. Our office staff also shifted in 2017. We had quite some turnover with the executive director moving out, the legislative coordinator also moving out, and also admin moving out. So we had the council stepped up at that time and really kept moving with only one paid staff member who were really moving things together, Patricia Bailey. And we were very thankful for his commitment to the council and the work that he does. And I know it's very difficult when you are only one left in institution. So it was really very transformative time for us. And so based on that, we learned a lot of lessons, and we engaged the communities very well. And with the communities between June and December, we had a lot of community forums engaging specifically around hiring the executive director, Justin Trail, who joined us December 1st, 2017. And we're very happy about that because we got a lot of input from community members, elected officials, and also the other councils as well. And I'm very thankful for the Latino and also Asian council as well for their input in the process. Moving forward in 2018, we developed really good partners to do the work that the council is required to do and fulfill the statutes as required by the state. We are recruiting the new member, and we just got Senator Hayden appointed to the council and joining us, and that includes Representative Moran, who has been on the council. So now we have two legislatures and also eight board members. So that is, I am pitching for all of you to join us, and we're looking for the GOP member, and I would like to have chair from this council, Mr. Chair, I'm pitching to you directly. That's my marketing a little bit. So we are in the process of also adding two staff members, the administrative and also the legislative coordinator, which will help us to do extensive work statewide and engage communities as they require or as they expected from us. So with that being said, Mr. Chair, I am very thankful about this opportunity, and I look forward to connecting with all of you and working with you in so that with that being said, I will introduce Justin Trail. Justin, welcome.
Yo, Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you to my chair, Nasser Musa, for all of his work. As he stated, we have been going through a time of transition with the council and his leadership, as well as our vice chair and all the council members have, and Patrice Bailey, our staff, have really done a great job navigating that transition. And I'm excited to talk about the work that we've done last year and the work going forward. So this is our annual report on our activities from 2017. Pardon me, I don't have the screen in front of me. It's just so I have to just look over my head. So in 2017, we primarily focused on two areas of work, legislative engagement at the legislature and engagement in the communities. So I'll start with our outreach report. So outreach report, we had basically, I'm just going to put all these up here so I can run through them quick. So over the summer of 2017, we visited seven cities across the state to engage members of the African Heritage community, and we held 80 meetings with local officials and members of the community to hear about the concerns in those cities. We had 27 meetings altogether, and this is a photo of Patrice Bailey, who is our outreach coordinator, doing what he does, talking with folks in the community. The cities we visited were Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester, and St. Cloud, Austin, and Moorhead. And we have some pretty unique stories about each one of those communities. So now I'm just going to put up the top five issues we heard about from our community members. So number one, no surprise, is economic development. Public safety came in as number two, which also isn't a surprise. Public safety is a huge concern to the African Heritage communities, especially when you consider high-profile cases involving police and also just the consistent concerns that we hear about the news in our communities. Police officers in schools was a surprise to me, but that's something that came up a lot. Housing, child welfare. So the total list is like 21 concerns that I compiled based on all the input we got from folks. And obviously this wasn't like a scientific report or anything, but we were just like hearing from community members and trying to consider what people were concerned about. Next, I'll talk about our legislative work from last year. So through session, we partnered with the Ethnic Councils to support the Increased Teachers of Color Act, which passed. We also worked on an updated version of the All Kids Count data disaggregation policy with the Department of Education, along with our Ethnic Council neighbors, and we're successful in those efforts as well. We also hosted two main events, our Day on the Hill, which we partnered with the United Black Legislative Agenda, which is a group based in Minneapolis. And then we also worked with our ethnic council partners to, and Senator Hurd to host the New American Forum. So let's talk about the work going forward. So when I came on to the council in December, you know, December 1st was my start date. My wife gave birth to a beautiful little boy 16 days later, and I had a month to write our annual report, which you all have in here, which really was 2 weeks. And so it's been a little bit of a whirlwind. But I want to be clear that we hit the ground running. And since then, we've developed a strategic direction for the council. We're talking about building a long-term agenda that addresses the needs of our community. However, we want to be clear that what we believe is best for our community is best for all Minnesotans. You heard about the demographics. You'll hear it over and over and over again that our state is changing. And if we don't solve the disparities, the racial disparities that impact all of our communities right now, Kennedy, Ohio County is in trouble, right? Austin, where you got Hormel, where 10% of the labor force is Sudanese, but are struggling to find housing, we need to address that, right? This is not just an urban problem. It's not just a black problem. It is a Minnesota problem, and we want our state to be as strong as possible. So we are thinking, working with partners across the state, to think about what are the issues that we need to address long-term, not just like one session at a time, but long-term, and how we build a coalition of lawmakers to come with us to make sure that the citizens in their community have access to the resources they need and the policies that govern them, set them up for success. We're also working to expand our team. We talked about staff, and we talked about the council members. We're currently down 3 council members and 2 legislative members. But we also want to build a table of partners. If you look on the back of the legislative agenda that I distributed to you, it shows you who we're working with right now. So African American Leadership Forum, Minneapolis NAACP, the Restore the Votes Coalition, and not to be confused with Black Lives Matter, but Black Votes Matter, is a group led by Deacon Robbins, who is working to engage, to provide civic engagement in Black communities for the fall. The last thing I want to mention about our strategic direction is that we are going to change the story about the African heritage community in our state. So right now we talk a lot about disparities, disparities, disparities. However, our state has a rich history that needs to be told about the African heritage community. We want to make sure that, you know, it's kind of like when somebody owes you money and you're like, are you going to pay me back? And then they say, well, what had happened was, and they tell you half the story. You know, the full story is they spent your money at McDonald's. Well, I want to make sure we tell the full story about the African heritage community in our state. I want to make sure we're talking about successes. I want to make sure we're talking about folks who are, you know, the Somali farmers that are growing in popular, that are moving to greater Minnesota and investing in those communities. I want to make sure we're investing in them. I want to make sure we're talking about, I want to make sure we're talking about the history, the rich history of African American neighborhoods and communities. There's currently a project going on right now to reconnect Rondo with the land bridge. I want to talk about opportunities to tell that full story. So that's what we're going to do this summer, which I will frame that up. It's going to pop up over my shoulder. So our work plan with our strategic direction is first, right now we're in phase one, working on our legislative agenda. As you see in front of you, some of those items have gotten hearings this year already. The Restoration of Voting Rights had a hearing with a very powerful and spirited debate that I deeply appreciated. It was a very nonpartisan, bipartisan debate, both people supporting Restoration of Voting Rights for people on probation and folks who had like genuine concerns about why they couldn't support the bill, even though they support the general idea of more people voting. And then the Increased Teachers of Color Act also had a hearing and received tons of bipartisan support, as well as, however, the African American Family Preservation Act. We had a press conference on Monday. Representative Lee was there, and it was very powerful to hear from the stories of families across the state who are experiencing child protection in a way that is not shared among other racial groups in the state. And so we want to make sure we tell their story. So that's what we're working on right now as far as our legislative agenda. This summer we'll launch our narrative project to make sure we're out in the community listening to people, not just talking about policy, but talking about the experiences of folks as African and heritage Minnesotans. And this fall we are going to engage in some civic engagement where we try to address the disparity in voting between between the African heritage community and other populations. So, I have like one talking point on this slide. So what have we done? this year so far. When I say we hit the ground running, I mean it. So first, the governor's MLK Day celebration was no small lift. We were part of the planning committee. We the same day we had to turn in our report, so that was fun. We also hosted a legislative breakfast to help kind of shape our agenda, and we hosted a day on the Hill where we had the privilege of hosting Mayor Carter, who is the first black mayor of St. Paul in his new official role. We're the first group to host him at the Capitol for an event in his new role. And we had great turnout. As far as I'm concerned, it was a packed rotunda of black and African folks, which is kind of our job, is to bring them to the Capitol. We also supported the librarian community at the DED rally last week. And if you saw that, President Trump actually, not to say directly in response to that rally, but President Trump did expand DED, and Senator Klobuchar and Senator Ellison, are both, Congressman Ellison, thank you, are both introducing legislation at the federal level for permanent status, which, you know, DED, if you don't know what it is, it's this ongoing temporary new policy for Liberians to stay in our state. And this is a huge population that matters to our state. We have to protect our Liberian neighbors. So we supported them, and then also we had Black Greek Day on the Hill, which is a Divine Nine Black sorority fraternities. And this past weekend, I'm happy to announce that we did our retreat, where our council members got together to build relationships and talk more about our bylaws, you know, the fun of setting our bylaws, but also to plan our direction forward. So that's my report on our 2017 work and where we're positioned right now. I'm excited to work with all of you going forward. Thank you for indulging me on my first hearing. I appreciate it. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I appreciate you taking the time to stop over and to visit with me prior to the meeting, getting a chance to get to know you. It was a pleasure to do that.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair.
We'll go with member questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious, you know, for the last several decades, in fact, some generations, there's some large school districts that have had disparity issues and, you know, graduation rate, and other issues. There have been a lot of programs that have been done over those decades, and we still, it's still a problem, still an issue. What of those programs aren't working, so that the ones that are, like Northside, they've got quite a few wonderful things. So if you could tell me what programs aren't working, so we can maybe look at switching the emphasis from what doesn't work to expanding what does work.
Mr. Trell, comments for the question? Follow-up there?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Crom, I don't have like a list of programs that are not working, right? I would argue that there's been some research, you know, recently about different parts of education that tend to impact communities of color differently. You know, we could talk about discipline in schools as being one of those. I would say that I'm open to a discussion that where we, you know, sort of crack the books wide open and look at all of it. Let's look at how our education system is actually serving communities of color. And as where, you know, we have a 64% graduation rate across the state, as where our white counterparts are graduating at like 90-something percent. Like, if the reverse were true, no one in this room would sit for that. And so I want to make sure that we, you know, I don't have any, like, in response to your exact question, just that I don't have a list of programs that are failing, but I do know those Northside programs that are working. I do believe the Grow Your Own program that's part of the Teachers of Color, Increase Teachers of Color Act, is something that we need more of. So I myself was a para at one point and wanted to become a teacher and didn't have the resources to pursue that. And I know that we need more teachers of color across the state, because we see that all students benefit when we have that. So not to dodge your question, Representative Crum, and I think it's an ongoing discussion that I would welcome.
Representative Crum, follow up?
No, actually, this year's And I'll be asking each of the councils, since there are the Office of the Ombudsperson is set up with four ombudspersons, and each is selected by one of four communities of color councils, three of which we're hearing today. And I'm going to ask each who their ombudsperson is and what were the special qualities in selecting that person.
And I know that the chair had a follow-up on that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kwam. In terms of the program that is working or that is not working, let me just say this first. The African heritage communities are very diverse and very complex. And I think with the data desegregation specifically from school, we will know specifically what program is working and what program is not working. Because right now, we don't have desegregated data for schools. And I know that when you lump sum the population into one category, it's really hard to pinpoint which specific demographic is doing very well and which is not doing well. So I think the data desegregation will help us understand where we can focus resources more and where we can understand the challenges specifically around the programs that are working or that are not working. And we will be more than happy to look at different programs and work with you and your office as well. Thank you so much.
I have a number of member questions, and I will just ask to follow up on the second question that's asked by Representative Kwam, the ombudsman question, because apparently he would like to hear that from each of the committee, from each of the councils, and so that may be helpful to just incorporate that at this point. And then, Representative Nelson, my apologies. Amanda was keeping a list, and I did not know that when I called Representative Kwam, so you will have the next question, but I want the ombudsman question, and you're on deck, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, it's a simple answer. I actually don't know where our ombudsman person is, and so I would, Representative Kwam, I'll look into that.
Very good. Representative Nelson, well, again, my apologies.
I didn't realize that I was after before or after, so that's no big deal.
Oh, then there wasn't a problem, Representative Nelson.
I have a couple of questions here as we were going through your report. The first one, when you were talking about the outreach top issues from 2017 report, police in schools. I guess the question, are they want more police in schools to keep it safe, or are they afraid of the police in schools? And I guess that's probably the easy question.
Mr. Trell, go ahead if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, it's primarily concerned about having police officers present in school. I don't think it's a surprise to some that having police, so if you look at the use of force policy guidelines for the city of Minneapolis, city of St. Paul, presence is considered a use of force by the police department in their own policy. And so considering the long history with police and communities of color in the state, which is something we need to work on those relationships, and I'm dedicated to that, it was clearly communicated to us that having officers in school just does not make certain students of color feel safe, right? Not to speak for everyone, but the ones that we spoke with and the parents we spoke with were clear that that was not something that made them feel safe.
Representative Nelson, follow-up?
Yeah, well, another question.
Certainly,
yeah,
go ahead.
Thank you. That's a good – I just want to make sure to clarify that so I know which way you're – you talked about in Austin housing issues, and I know that's an issue across the state, workforce housing that we've been trying to deal with for many years here. Is it a lack of housing or lack of affordable housing for the wages that the people are making down there? What is the issue there?
Mr. Trull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, that report was put together before my time, so I don't know, I can't speak to the exact nuances. My understanding is that, not to say that their wages are fine, my gut says everyone would like their wages to go up, but that it's access, being in a new community in Austin, having access to housing where some landlords and property owners may not be comfortable. This has been a theme, this is a theme across multiple cities with commercial property, rental properties, just that people, some landlords aren't comfortable with not understanding the culture of the people who are trying to gain access to those properties. And so there's a conflict there, is my understanding.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Bliss, followed by Peterson and then
Jeff. Chair, I got one more question.
Oh, sorry, Representative Nelson. Go ahead.
And you talked about getting more...
Phone check, folks. There we go. Thank you.
Getting more voting going on and getting more people voting. We heard a report yesterday about the voter registration system here. What is the barrier that you see to getting more, raising that number of people voting?
So I think there's a lot, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Nelson. I think there's a lot of barriers. You know, primarily, if you've ever done any civic engagement, door knocks, which I'm sure all of you have. I would be interested in taking an informal poll if you've ever heard someone answer the door and say, I can't vote. Even though I like to vote for you, I can't vote because I have a felony, which is not true. Right, you're talking about if you're on felony probation, but then you got to argue with somebody to go to the polls, and they don't want to commit voter fraud. And so that's one experience that I've had over and over and over again. And in communities of color, which you're talking about a state where we have, where African Americans and African immigrant communities make up 6% of the state's population, we make up 35% of the prison population. And stuff like that, it's just not an accident. Like, we have these systems that move people down paths, and we want folks to be able to take control of their own lives and fully participate in society. And there's multiple barriers that kind of get in the way of that. So democracy becomes a very low priority for folks who are trying to get a job, trying to find housing. And if they don't have time to follow you to the polls, if they're living in crisis, and that's true for all communities in Minnesota. And so I would say, I would argue that it's on our agenda. Restoration of voting rights is one of the first things that we could take on to remove a significant barrier. And then beyond that, you know, there's quite a few policies, but we don't have time to get into all that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Bliss, followed by Representative Peterson.
Actually, Representative Nelson asked my question, so I'm good.
Very good. I like when you team up like that. Representative Peterson, followed by Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Switching gears, I was looking over your 2017 legislation pieces, and I just met with a group of Asians, and they were very concerned about the ethnicity breakdowns in the desegregation of data for students. And I just was curious to know what your thoughts were on that piece of it, if you had any opinion one way or the other.
Mr. Mansa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I can specifically directly speak to that because I came from a different background. When I came here about 12 years ago, within the Ethiopian community, there's a Romo, there's Amhara, there's Somali. These groups are very diverse and very large, and we didn't know which group is doing well and which group is not doing well. But I think by desegregating data and having that specific problem pointing out to one group, we can have capacity or develop a capacity to address that specific problem. And I've worked on this issue, not school-related, but the community-related with the city of Minneapolis, because the city of Minneapolis has a large number of Somali and a large number of Oromo ethnic group as well. So the city has this program called East African. So the East Africa, within East Africa, there's a lot of communities. There's a Kenyan, there's an Ethiopian, there's an Eritrean, and there's a Oromo, and all these groups are lumped up in one category. So when you lump sum all this group in one category and not really looking at data of improvement, I think that would create a problem. So I 100% believe and strongly support that the data desegregation is a way to really look at which group is doing well and which group is not doing well. And I think that is one way of improving the performance in the school and the community as well.
Representative Pearson, quick follow-up.
Well, thank you for that. It's been causing some problems in this other ethnic group because there's been confusion just because they may speak a different language at home, but they're born in America. They're being labeled as they don't understand English, and that's not true. So have you run into any issues like that as well?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Terrell, he had pointed at you, so I'm calling on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, so this is actually a really important issue, and part of the issue is that this one community that you're talking about is having a unique experience, right? Mm-hmm. And if we don't disaggregate the data, we actually won't be able to, like, count that experience. At the same time, I agree with my chair, obviously, and I'm a big supporter of data disaggregation so that we can, you know, once again, tell the full story and not the half. But I will say that there's a history of, and this is true for all of our communities, like, there's a history of the government using data and to sort of, you know, do inappropriate things. You know, for the Asian community, I would assume internment and those ideas come up in those conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think that's valid. I think that's a valid concern. Mm-hmm. However, I think what's more valid and what we have to address more directly is the fact that Oromo and Somali are not the same, that Chinese and Hmong are not the same, and that we cannot erase the experiences of entire communities, because we know that we need to govern communities in a way that works for them, right? Like, we don't want the government to prescribe to everyone what they should be doing in a uniform manner, right? We need folks to have agency over their own communities and be able to talk about the needs of their communities that are specific. And so I would say we need to have this conversation with those folks and find a way to address their concerns, make sure they're included in the category that fits for them, even though we know that boxes and categories are not always the best way to do things. But we definitely need to make sure that folks' identities don't get erased. That's how I look at this issue.
Mr. Chair, for the full record.
Mr. Monson, just very quickly, I will ask you to make your comments brief because we do have two other councils that we need to hear from. I do have one other member question. I want to be fair to each of the councils today with their time. So if you will.
Representative Peterson, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Peterson. For the full record, I'm a trilingual, so I want to be used in that way. And if people don't collect my data specifically and recognize me as Oromo, trilingual, because these are the skills, and these are something that we can capture only by desegregating data. And otherwise, I think we'll be not able to understand which community is struggling and which community is thriving within the group. Thank you.
Mr. Winston, my apologies for mispronouncing your name as well. My apologies. Representative Jessup, you have the last quick question here before we bring up the next council. Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Chair. I'm looking at your annual report for 2018, and on the Section 3, it talks about demographics. And I was looking here where you've got the five top African immigrant groups.
Yep.
And I've got Liberians there at 10,880. We've had the news about the Liberians, and I have to say I'm concerned. I think on the paper there was, in the St. Paul paper, they talked about potentially up to 4,000 that are in this situation where they have a year before they, at this point, have to be deported back to Liberia. I'm very concerned about that, and I'm glad to hear that Representative Ellison, Senator Klobuchar, have got some petitions out there. And I guess I want to ask two questions. One is that number correct? And then number two, I want to ask, what efforts can your group do? What efforts could we do? What efforts could be done by the business community that employs several of these individuals? Thank you.
Mr. Trump?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm sorry, Representative.
Jessup,
thank you so much. The answer to your question is, are they being kind of correct? The answer is no. Right? The number, so when I shared this report with our Nigerian friends, they all but stormed our office and said, you're not counting, like, you're off by like 30,000 people, right? We know that there's a problem in counting these communities, once again, for the concerns mm-hmm. that folks are bringing up related to the disaggregated data issue. And then as far as, like, what we can do, you know, we work with partners and allies to one of our council members actually has been going to D.C. on a weekly basis with community members from the Liberian community to really work on this issue in the state and D.C. And I would say locally, I do think getting businesses involved is a great idea. I'll just defer to the coalition of folks that are working on this, but I definitely we definitely see ourselves. We're putting out a statement. We're going to continue to work on this issue. I would say anything we can do to support Senator Klobuchar and Congressman Ellison's efforts should also be a top priority.
Very good. With that, there's always more questions and more dialogue than we have time for on the agenda, and I want to thank both of you for being with us here today. Members, I also encourage you to engage these gentlemen and others from the Minnesota African Heritage community if you have further questions. And again, with the thanks of the committee, appreciate you both being here today and sharing your progress. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you so much.
And with that, we will now bring up members from the Asian Pacific community for their presentation. And Representative Bliss, I'm going to ask if you would be willing to step forward and to chair this council presentation, sir.
Thank you. Could you please state your name for the record before you begin, please?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sia Kerr, and I am the Executive Director of the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans.
And Mr. Chair, my name is David Maeda. I'm the Chair of the Asian Council.
Thank you. Please proceed.
First of all, let me just thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for having us before you this morning. As I said, I'm Sia Kerr, and I'm the executive director. A fun fact is that I am beginning my sixth year as executive director at the Asian Council. Since this is my sixth year, and I've never come before this committee before, I brought almost my entire team with me today. So in addition to our board chair, our vice chair, Mr. Dave Hong, is also here, as well as our research director, Ms. Anjali Cameron, our research assistant, Mr. Dave Supran, and our Humphrey Fellow, who was here but left just a short while ago for a legislative visit. I will start off our presentation this morning by just sharing with you that our council was created in 1985 in the wake of an influx of refugees from Southeast Asia. Specifically, we're talking about the kingdoms of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. In 1985, the API community in the state of Minnesota was about 1% of the total population here in the state of Minnesota. Today, we are slightly more than 5% of the total population. We are also arguably the state's most diverse and the fastest growing minority community, and the median age of our community is 10 years younger than Minnesota's general population. Just a few facts about our community. So I began my tenure as executive director in March of 2013. Several months later, I believe it was either July or August, the legislative auditor informed our office that they would begin auditing the ethnic councils as well as the Native Affairs Council. In 2014, as some of you may recall, the OLA issued a report on these councils. And in this report, they provided information on the council's histories, their demographics, their statutory responsibilities, and the opinions of their constituents, including individuals and organizational leaders. The OLA, as you may recall, recommended that the legislature consider four options for these councils, two of which included, one, reforming them, or two, eliminating them. In 2015, you may recall that the legislature reformed the three ethnic councils. Right now, we share one enabling statute, and this statute contains a number of provisions that were not present in our respective enabling statutes up until 2015. These key provisions include a clarified purpose and mission, spelled out duties of the board members, mandatory training for the newly governor-appointed members to be administered by the Department of Administration, bipartisan, bicameral, and voting legislative board members. It's important for me to point out that before the restructuring, before 2015, the legislative members of the boards did not have a vote. This another provision included term limits for both the legislative and the community board members, and then, of course, a role for the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and I see Greg Hubinger, the executive director of the LCC, here today. So the ethnic councils today, we believe at the Asian Council, have a much clearer purpose. And our purpose is to work to improve the economic and social conditions of the communities we seek to represent within state government. Our board members have clear duties and responsibilities, including collaborating with the executive directors who carry out the council's duties, participating in activities the council or the executive director deems appropriate to facilitate the council's duties, and, of course, actively communicating with the community that the board member seeks to represent on the respective council's boards. Subdivision 8 of our enabling statute mandates that each of us submit an annual report to the appropriate Senate and House committees by January 15th of each year, which brings us to why we're reporting before the committee this morning. With the clarified duties of the council, their executive directors, and their board members, we at the Asian Council believe that since 2015, we have been better positioned to advise state government, advocate for our many communities, and bridge the gap that often exists between state government and the different communities that seek to become much more engaged and informed as far as government is concerned. So this morning, I'll just highlight for you a few of the legislative achievements for the Asian Council during the 2017 calendar year. I'll start off by simply pointing out that we now have a strategic plan for the next two biennium. The board just ratified the strategic plan in January of 2018 this year. This is significant because one of the concerns highlighted in the OLA report in 2014 was that we may have strategic plans in place, but that we were not necessarily clear about our duties and measurements were not in place to measure the impact of the work that we were doing. And so our plan is actually the result of a two-year-long process during which we sought input from key constituents, meaning members, individuals, and organizational leaders, and, of course, members of the legislative and executive branches of state government. We believe that what we have right now is a strategic plan that contains realistic goals, and these goals are aligned with organizational strategies to ensure that every action we take has a strong relationship with our statutes, our council's ability to deliver on our statutory duties. Secondly, we have a strong and consistent focus on advising the legislature on issues of importance to our communities. In 2014, another finding of the OLA report was that we were focusing on cultural community events rather than actively advising the body that creates public policies for our state. And so since I've been executive director, we've been actively advising the legislature as well as the executive branch of government, and we do this in a number of ways. One that I, as executive director, am particularly proud about is the work that we have done with legislators to pass, as it relates to passing legislation that addresses immediate concerns or issues of importance to the API community. Since 2014, in partnership with the legislature, we have passed a number of bills that originated out of our office. These successful legislative efforts, for one, resulted in what we know as the Working Group on Violence Against Asian Women and Girls in the state of Minnesota. As a result of that group's work in 2017, we submitted to the appropriate committees in the House and in the Senate a report that covered the scope, the nature, and the prevalence of violence against Minnesota's Asian women and children. The findings and the recommendations of that report guided the Asian Council's community engagement throughout 2017, which led us up to what we brought to the legislature this session, and that was House File 3304, the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Prevention Program Bill. In addition to legislative initiatives that came out of our office, we also worked closely with our other ethnic councils as well as community-based organizations and other advocates, and we believe that our effort contributed significantly to the passage of the Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers Bill. In 2017, our council also continued to work on a report that we're very excited about, Since I've been executive director, we have issued a number of original research reports. This is the latest report that we're working on. And it's a report focusing on Minnesota's emerging Asian Pacific Islander communities. This is what we consider in-house to be an original research report. This report will feature the Karen, the Karenese, the Bhutanese, the Guyanese, and the Chukis communities in Minnesota. I expect that most of you have never heard about some of these communities. That's one of the reasons why we're producing this report. At the council, we believe that although time in America changes people more than they change America, and that comes directly out of my favorite American history class in high school, and that American teacher stands out in my memories because he always said, as much as people change America, America changes people more. And it's been my lived experiences that theory is more than a theory. So at the Asian Council, we do our work based on a number of principles, and one is that people do not immediately check their histories, their identities, and their lived experiences upon arrival at Ellis Island or at the airport. With this report on the emerging communities, our council hopes to shed light on the resettlement experiences of these communities, the trending issues in each of the communities, and consequently, we hope that we are contributing to your understanding of Minnesota's less visible communities under the broad umbrella of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Looking forward, we are actually quite excited about this summer. We plan to complete the Emerging Communities Report. We also plan to deploy our biennial community survey, which will be done online as well as in person. We plan to travel throughout the state of Minnesota to where we believe there are critical masses of our communities. And we do the traveling simply because of a few facts, one of which is that we are a community with high percentages of limited English proficient communities, and so we need to deploy our survey in person to try to cast as wide of a net as possible. The results of the survey will directly shape our legislative agenda for the next biennium, and we do this on a biennial basis. We will also continue to engage with stakeholders to maximize the chances that the domestic violence and sexual assault bill will succeed in the 2019 session. You haven't seen us as much as you should because our bill died before the first committee hearing. So we're hoping to focus much attention on making sure that we're better prepared in the next session. We also plan to continue focusing on strengthening our council infrastructure. So members of the committee, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do so much more than what I can share with you during the course of this committee meeting. I'll conclude by simply saying that we strive to do as much as we can with the resources and the support that you have lent to us, as well as the support of our community. And each year, our council endeavors to put together an annual report that helps our constituents, mainly you and our community members, to better understand how we carry out our role and our responsibilities as a state agency, and, of course, so that you better understand the change we've effected within state government on behalf of these communities we seek to represent. Each of you should have received a hard copy of our 2017 report sometime in February. For the purposes of this morning's committee, we also made sure that you have, and you should have in front of you, an exact copy of what was sent to you in February. This year, we are trying a slightly new tactic with our annual report in that it's created to act as a folder. And so tucked into the back of that report is a number of documents, one of which is a document depicting our current board members. So I'll just end here by saying that on behalf of that board, and even with my chair and my vice chair here, thank you to all of you and the rest of the legislature for the trust that you put in our office. We look forward to continuing to work with you in the governor's office in our shared pursuit of an increasingly informed and engaged government and citizenry. Thank you so much, and we're happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Representative Quam earlier asked a question about an ombudsman. Do you have any information on that you can share with us?
Our boards, our chair, in fact, I believe in statute, has the authority of making recommendations as to who should be appointed as the Asian board as the Asian members on the board of the Ombudspersons for Families. And so once we make those recommendations, we work much more closely with the Ombudsperson rather than the board members. I think my chair has a few words to say on this, and so I'll just turn it over to him to address the rest of the
question. Thank you. Mr. Morita, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is David Maeda. I'm the chair of the board. When I first was appointed to the board in 2014, I knew nothing about this process, but when I became chair, I actually made it a point last fall to meet with our ombudsperson and learn more about what she actually does and what her challenges are. And I thought we had a very productive meeting, and again, the challenges she faces, I think, are a matter of resources, which is not uncommon, but it was a very educational meeting for me to just learn what that process is about.
And Mr. Chair,
earlier
I heard Representative Guam, I believe, mention, what are some of the characteristics that we take into consideration when we're, determining who we should recommend in terms of appointments. I recall that in our board meetings we talked about the general knowledge that each applicant appears to have as indicated in their resumes. We particularly look for a broad level of understanding about our many communities under the Asian Council umbrella. And specifically, we're looking at whether they understand the nature of the linguistic and the cultural challenges that come into play given the jurisdiction of that office. And so, in general, I just simply wanted to share that.
Thank you, Ms. Hurt. Representative Halverson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Forgive me, I've had a cold. A few things are rattling in my head, and forgive me if I am less than articulate today. The cold is not making me very smart, but I grew up in a part of Minnesota that was very an isolated community with an immigrant history, but the immigrants were Swedish. And when I go back and visit my community, I'm amazed at how much the immigrant story is celebrated there. In fact, there's a new monument that just got built called the Immigrant Story that features statues about why people left, what they did once they got to the United States, to this little community, and how they impacted the community. And there's even a place, and I invite you all to go up and visit, ask Representative New to go visit her community. Take a hike, take a drive on the Immigrant Trail. And that's what we call it up there. It's the Immigrant Trail. There's a historic landmarks that are dedicated to the immigrant story. And so I was very, very struck by the stories that you included here, asking these very same questions that kind of I grew up learning, right? Why did the people leave? Where did they settle? Why? What impacts are they having on the community? So I think these stories are really important to tell. And when I was marveling at how much we celebrate the immigrant story in my hometown, and how sometimes the immigrant stories that we tell about newer immigrants, newer arrivals, are not met with the same kind of celebration. Somebody said something to me that stuck with me that I wanted to share, and that was that you were always empowered and encouraged and celebrated with your immigrant story. And not everybody is, and I thought that was really significant. So I just wanted to share that. And that, I think, is a really important lens, since so many of us have immigrant stories in our backgrounds. Secondly, I wanted to ask, from a personal standpoint and also a community standpoint, there are a number of Asian Pacific Minnesotans that are part of families through adoption. And I ask this personally. I'm raising a Korean immigrant and very proud Korean immigrant. And so have you found that the immigrant community of adoptees is engaging with the council? Are there ways that we can help? Because Minnesota has quite a big history. I think that we have the largest population of Korean adoptees in the country. Is the adoptee community seen as part of the council's work?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, thank you for that question. I think I'm going to encourage my chair to also address this question because it is a very important question. But before I address your question directly, I just want to thank you for bringing your son to our 2017 dinner. It was a fabulous event, and I saw you and your son, but I didn't have an opportunity to come up and thank you personally for attending that dinner. So now to your question, you are right that Minnesota is home to a large population, if not the largest population of Korean adoptees in the country. We have had, there have been times during my tenure when we have had a stronger relationship with this particular community under our umbrella. We have been invited to present to the parents of these adopted children. We have been asked tough questions by them. And then, of course, we have a number of professors around the state who are themselves adoptees. And so we continue to have conversations with them about how we can better weave them into the culture of the Asian Council. And we are nowhere near where we should be, but we absolutely recognize that it is one of the areas that we need to put concerted effort and resources into to make sure that they feel and believe that they are a part of our community, because they are. And throughout the years and any and every conversation we have had with them, I think one of the challenges that they have brought to our attention is a challenge related to identity, belonging. Do they belong to their adoptive, to the community that their adoptive parents are members of? Or do they belong to our community because they have shared physical features with us, right? And that's an ongoing conversation, and it's important for us to have, because the best society is a society where the individuals feel that they are truly home.
Mr. Maeda.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, I second what Sia just said. I think our board can do a much better job of engaging with adoptees. That said, my own personal experience, one of my closest friends out of college is a Korean-American adoptee. She grew up in Anoka, and it was very, very telling to me when we shared our own personal stories with each other how we both grew up Asian in very white settings, but her experience had this entire other layer upon it, because as Ms. Her just said, her identity was issues totally were something foreign to even me growing up, being born here and raised by a Japanese-American family. She grew up with a white family, and just trying to figure out how being Korean fit into her life was really a challenge for her, and I'll never forget that. And so I agree, we need to better engage with those with a similar story.
Ms. Hurt?
Mr. Chair, I want to just also add another comment, because I feel that it's important to make that comment here in front of all of you. And it's a comment in response to what Representative Halverson said about celebrating the immigrant story. You know, I want to just remind everyone that the flip side of celebrating or telling the immigrant story is really telling the story of America and telling, you know, really reminding Americans that an immigrant success is really a manifestation of the power of the American dream. You know, we often look at the many communities that make up our community, and Minnesota's API community is unique from any other state's community in that it is a refugee majority. A refugee experience majority. And so whether they are refugees or came here as immigrants, it's incredibly important to remind everyone that we're talking about the story of America as a city on the hill. We're talking about Americans who came here once upon a time with almost nothing to them but the hopes and the dreams and the memories of what they left behind and the hope that someday they could overcome those circumstances and fulfill their potential. And so in telling the American story, we are actually telling the American story, and we're really, you know, feeding facts into the story that America really is that place. And so we hope that as we're sharing stories about immigrants and their experiences in America, that you don't recognize that it's simply immigrant stories, right? But that it is the American story, and we're just testifying to the power of this nation and the conditions that your conditions have made possible. Because, you know, there's a Buddhist saying, rice doesn't grow, right, just anywhere. It grows where the conditions are right? And you as public policymakers, you make the incredible decisions that make those conditions possible. And so when people come here with nothing but hopes and dreams, the conditions that are here in place make those dreams and those hopes what they are.
Thank you. Now, Representative Peterson?
Wow. Thank you for that. I'm all clumped. So, again, switching gears to sort of my previous conversation, and first I want to thank all of the councils for their work and their dedication to our communities. It's very much appreciated. But looking into this ethnicity data segregation with our students, I looked up the bills, and neither bill was heard in the education committee, so this was something that became law out of negotiations. And so, and if you don't have a comment on it, that's perfectly fine because it's not part of your initiatives here. But if you do have an opinion on the breakdown of ethnicity and any comment on it, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Ms. Hurd, would you care to comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I absolutely would love to comment on this. You are talking about the All Kids Act, right? All Kids Count Act, which was brought to the legislature in 2016 and then brought back in 2017 for some amendments to the language. The Asian Council has a longstanding position in support of data disaggregation, and the reason for that has to do with what I pointed out earlier, which is that our API community is a community where there is a majority of refugee experienced members. The support for data disaggregation falls in line with, you know, our immigrant community relative to our refugee community. And so, Representative Peterson, your district, according to the demographics of your district, you have slightly more than 4% API, and the largest ethnic group you have in terms of the API community is our Chinese community. And where we see the strongest pushback on data disaggregation is from our Chinese American community. That's quite understandable because when we look to poverty, you know, levels within these respective communities, our Chinese community is one of our more established communities. It is definitely one of our more affluent communities. And so we understand the nature of their pushback on data disaggregation, but we have a position in support of data disaggregation. And the reason for that is because refugee experienced students, when you look at their graduation rates, you may not see any red flags, but when you look to their MCA test scores, to their performances, you'll see the discrepancies there, and those discrepancies are seen where our Southeast Asian student populations are concerned. So if you look at the Hmong, the Vietnamese, the Karen, which is our largest emerging refugee community, you'll see that they are performing on par with our African American students or our Native American students. And so data disaggregation is an attempt to understand how the lived experiences of these respective communities influence their ability to absorb and to retain what they are learning inside the classrooms. And so, you know, I would give you that. And, you know, we have been hearing from members of our Chinese community, and, you know, we are committed to working with them and all of you to ensure that the concerns that they have are addressed appropriately and to the extent possible in a timely manner. But we remain committed to our position unless my board says otherwise. We will continue to support data disaggregation. And I would add for the purpose of this committee as well as other legislators that data disaggregation is a nationwide movement, and it has been at play for several decades now because community leaders from a broad, you know, from a cross-sector of our communities understand that data disaggregation can really help to lift up the almost invisible communities within our community. Because the fact of the matter is that the Asian community is not, it's not always true that we are the model minority. And that myth and that national narrative is doing a great disservice to the communities that are not doing so well.
Mr. Maeda, you care to comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Peterson, the only comments I'll add is our, obviously our board has heard from this Chinese community and we take the concerns very seriously. I think the concern they're raising is the possibility of creating some type of ethnic registry. And as a Japanese American whose father is actually part of the internment, I mean, I take that very seriously, the government abuse of power. But I think there are safeguards in place in the All Kids Count Act that completely take away any concerns I would have that were going down that road. And if I ever saw that as an issue, I certainly would get our board to readdress that issue.
Representative Peterson, a follow-up? Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, Chair O'Driscoll, sorry.
I'm still a representative. At least as far as I know, Chair Bliss. I would like to follow back on something that Representative Halverson said, and Kai is just a great kid. I've seen him grow up here at the legislature, and that kind of reminded me when we were having that conversation, we brought that up, that I have a cousin who's more like a brother to me, and he and his wife had also adopted a Korean girl at about age one, and I was honored enough to be able to be at a lot of the events for her. One of them was when she came to the United States, and when she came off the aircraft and saw me, she started wailing, and I don't think that's connected. At least I hope that's not connected with her first laying eyes on me. We later found out, and we knew from the folks who were accompanying her to the United States, that she had a double ear infection and had flown all the way from South Korea through Detroit to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I was relieved to find that the two weren't connected, but I was also very concerned about her health and well-being. So where am I going with this? She was one of the very first people that I bonded with, or she bonded with, when she came to the United States. And so at family functions, she would always run to familiar faces, which was her parents or me, which I always thought that was kind of cool. So where am I going with this whole story? One of the things that her parents did that I thought was very helpful as an immigrant to the United States is they wanted to make sure that she was involved in Korean camps and with cultural preservation types of things. And she has a sister who was biological with her parents, and they also wanted to make sure that her sister was involved in that so that they understood the special bond that the two of them had and the cultural differences. So my question is, what is the council doing right now to try to foster those kinds of situations where you not only have children who might be immigrants of biologicals who have come here, but you also have immigrants of blended families who are here to try to help with those kinds of things for family awareness as well as cultural preservation?
Ms. Herr or Ms. Maeda? Ms. Herr?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's a wonderful question. Thank you for raising it. To the best of my recollection as executive director, the simple answer is that we're not doing much, and that's because we're not able to do much, and that's because I'm really trying to tell you that next year is an appropriations year, and you could definitely give us more money so that we could do more in this area. We issued a report, an original research report in 2016, I believe, and it was focused on Southeast Asian children as it relates to early childhood education. And what we walked away with from that project was that parents want cultural and linguistic retention because they believe that language and culture opens the world in the eyes of a child to a world that they may not necessarily see all the time, and that will help to ground them in who they are. And so, before then and after that, we continue to hear from members of the community that they would like more programs focused on language and cultural retention. And so that's an area that we have talked about a lot internally, and we even have a legislative proposal drafted in-house, but we haven't been able to move forward with it. So I'd love to schedule a follow-up meeting with you and have this have a much more nuanced conversation about the possibilities.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that our time is limited. Ms. Herr, I'm happy to have that conversation. And I knew when I asked the question that there was going to be an appropriations question. I would have expected nothing different from testifiers, defending their territory and their ground. Are you keeping an informal registry or anything, or is that something that you could take in with the people that you're talking with, the community that you're working with, to start putting an informal registry together for parents who simply ask the question, what's available? Because there are things that are out there that I don't think would necessarily cost money to put the programs in place, but there are different organizations and groups that are doing those. I know it would have been more helpful for my cousin and his family to be able to have had that, where they had to search that out, and they would now could have used your services and used the council as a resource for that. That's maybe more of a comment, and maybe there's an answer to a question of a registry in there as well.
Ms. Herr, would you care to respond.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, first of all, I brought up the appropriations comment, but I assure you that we won't ask for more than what we absolutely believe we can deliver on. And so having said that, I want to assure you that, you know, in our statutory role and responsibilities, we serve as an entity whereby community members, anyone, any Minnesotan can call us up and ask us questions about existing resources. And most of the time, almost all the time, we have an answer. We, if we don't have an answer in-house, we know who to go to get an answer. And so, you know, we have some semblance of an internal database going on, but I would just encourage you or anyone else on this committee, if anyone does call or you know is seeking resources or access to organizations that provide services, we're more than happy to help. And for the most part, I think that we're confident about our ability to identify the appropriate organizations if they do exist.
Okay, seeing no more member questions, Ms. Hurd and Mr. Maeda, thank you very much for your testimony. And if we could get the Latino present, the Latino Affairs Council to come down and present.
Chair, while we're waiting, I just something I want to say to all the councils, and while we're waiting for them to get the report done, is with the census coming up in 2020, we need to make sure, you know, the number of the first presentation, there was numbers there, and there were some questions about how those numbers are actually accurate. We need to make sure that when the census is up, that all the groups here make sure that their members reach out and get themselves counted and answer the questions in the census. Even though there are some things that are being put in there that give some of them, might give some of them heartburn, we need to have those answered because it's important we have a full and accurate count of the people living in Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also while they're getting that ready, part of the reason for bringing up the ombudsperson is that in statute, not only is the appointing set up to, four councils, but it's specifically stated that the, although independent, the ombudsperson is to coordinate with their appointing entity, which would be each of these councils. And that's part of the reason it's a very important function, because that ombudsperson is the independent person that those communities can go to for assistance. And that's I hope the next council, that the last council was very good at describing what they looked at in that person.
Well, welcome to the committee. If you would please state your names, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Angelica Klevish. I'm the chair of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, and Representative Jessup, actually, my family is four of the 1,800 Latinos in your district in 42A. I was appointed to the council 2 years ago. I became the chair this year. And I have to tell you, you know that they are voluntary positions, but sometimes it feels like a full-time job. When I first came aboard the council, I met with Executive Director Jimenez, and he shared that OLA report that Sia mentioned earlier. And it raised a lot of concerns for me as far as the efficacy of the council and how well it might actually be serving the community. And I, as an incoming member, how could I amplify the ability of the council to be a bridge and a translator, really, for the community on policy issues? There were several new board members when I came aboard, and so we immediately had a strategic planning meeting so that we could collectivize all of this excitement and energy that we were all bringing and decide what was the best direction that the council could take to serve the community best. That was in the summer of 2016, and I can tell you a year and a half later, we have met almost all of our goals. Executive Director Jimenez will give you a lot of details on the work of the council, but what I really want to share with you is from the perspective of a board member. We're a very excited, very collaborative board. We have great energy together. We're very engaged. We've been deploying out in the community to support and foster the work of the staff. And so we are actually going to have our retreat this coming Saturday to come up with a new strategic plan. We once again have several new board members, and we want to engage them, make sure that they feel that they're part of the mission and the direction of the council. Those 15 goals included a lot of heavy engagements in the community. We read in the OLA report how disconnected the council had been in the past, and that was something that we were all determined to change. And again, Henry will have details on that for you. But the listening tour that we went on included both several communities in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. We made several trips out there. It was the first time I went to Rochester and the first time I went to St. Cloud. I am not a native Minnesotan. I've been here since 2011. So this was a great opportunity for me to see what the rest of the community looked like in the diaspora, really, that is Minnesota for Latinos. At each one of these community forums, the turnout was big. It was more than I expected for a council that's focused on policy. We weren't talking about, you know, specifically educational measures, although certainly that's part of the policy that we cover. But this was strictly on policy, and I've never seen a community so engaged. We took it as a personal mission to not just translate the policy in language, but to translate it in accessibility and make sure that our community understood what we do for them and what kind of a resource we can provide for them. Once we come to you with resources and data to support the work that you do, because we know that policymaking is not easy or pretty, and the agency has really tried hard to produce data that is specific to your districts and that you can trust and rely on. We've produced economic data for you, jobs data, educational data, and so forth. We also share that with community and make sure that they are represented in those numbers, because each one of those numbers is really a story. We come back to the community and hold these listening sessions and hearing sessions and share back with them what's happening in the Capitol. And again, the turnout is huge. They're very interested. They're very engaged. So again, I'm honored to be serving on this board. I really thank you for your continuing support of the ethnic councils. The work that we're able to do for community is, I'm telling you, it's fantastic work. It's inspiring. We're building trust with the community. We're bridge building. We continue to translate for them and be a resource that both you and they can trust.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Henry Jimenez. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs and have been so since the transition, so just a little over 2 years. My colleague mentioned that he hit the ground running, and let me tell you, you would think I would be in better shape because I don't feel like I ever stopped running. And that's because I have a great team. And when you have a great team, it doesn't slow your work down. They encourage you to do more work. So I want to acknowledge Rosa Polk, who does our health work, Violeta Hernandez, who does our education work, Eric Armankanki, who focuses on economic development. And even more important, we need more help than just that, including the board. But this year we were able to add 5 fellows, or also known as interns, but to us, they're more than interns. So I want to thank Abigail Flores, Caroline Peters, Justo Ramirez, Isaac Mendoza, Marco Hernandez. We have to get creative, right? And I would love to tell you how much I would want to have and what kind of a budget I would like to have, but the reality is we have a budget and we have a mandate. And I think our board has set a direction that as much as we would like to do everything for our community, it's really 4 FTEs with some additional help. So let's focus on four areas that we can become experts in. And I strongly believe that that's what we've become in the last 2 years. I would like to bring attention to your packet. One of the first things you'll see is this district fact sheet. It has your name on it. Mm-hmm. And it has your name on it for a reason, because it's specific to your district. We want to make sure you know what the Latino labor force participation rate is,
yeah,
and compare it to the average in your district and to the state. We want you to know what the median household incomes are, as well as the high school equivalency or higher for folks over the age of 25 years old. And then at the bottom, you'll see how it compares, how Latinos have the highest labor force participation rate in the state. Really proud of that. Our community works, just like all the other emerging communities or immigrant communities. Our community is working at higher rates than anyone else. But unfortunately, it has the third highest median household income. So that's one fact sheet. I would love to talk to you about this for 2 hours, but I have a few minutes left. The next thing is you have a one-pager, just quickly, about just who is on our council. If you look at the back, don't worry, it's in Spanish. It's two languages, and there's a reason for that. I'm lucky that we focus only on English and Spanish, but my colleagues, I don't know how Sia does it, dozens of languages. So does Justin Terrell. I would like to say I'm pretty lucky to only have Spanish and some other native languages. That we'll get there, but we're focusing right now. The next thing you'll see is our legislative priorities. It's a one-pager. One of the first things, and I think actually Representative Odrescu told me this, one page will do you well. Don't bring me too many things. One page will do you well. So here's a one page of the work. Obviously, we're doing more than this, but this is how we focus our attention. You'll see that it's, again, four areas. You'll continuously hear me say education, health, economic development, immigration. Is there other things that are important to us? Absolutely. Four FTEs, five fellows. And that's what we're going to be experts at moving forward. Because this is also the Elections Policy Committee, I thought you would find this interesting. This is a map. And it's not a map that somebody else put together. It's a map that we put together, that one of our fellows put together. Caroline Peters put this together for us. This is the type of information we want to be able to provide to you so that you're able to make decisions that are best for our community. And again, you'll see our legislative report and community engagement report. So I'm watching time, so I'm trying to go really fast here. So I want you to open the legislative report, which is this one. And if you turn to page 4, I'll just point out a couple highlights. Again, some of our legislative achievements, if you can look at just the trajectory when we, in 2015, there was a part-time person focus on the legislative process. Yes, it's four of us, but to only have a part-time person focus on the legislative process, well, that's probably why you never saw us. Well, that's probably why you never got a position statement or a graph or seeing our community be brought to testify. We were able to change our we were able to change our structure in 2016, and we're finally what we are now, that everybody is focused on the legislative and policymaking process. That is what our statute says we're supposed to do. That is what we are interested in doing. If there's other things that we can help our community with, of course we would take it on. But note to yourself, those are additional things that are not in statute. I think that if we're going to be successful, focus on what your intentions were of us to do. As you can see, we met we had over 200 meetings last year and tracked 117 bills. That's a lot. That's a lot of bills. I know that you all like to introduce 4,000. I would love for you to slow it down because, believe it or not, if it's not me reading them, it's one of my fellows or one of my board members. Slow it down. You know. Give it some more thought. We try to provide you where what our position will be, and we like to do it in a respectful way. If we're opposing one of your bills, I would prefer to have that conversation one-to-one with you, right? It doesn't need to come to public. I know that there's a lot of things happening, but there will be moments where that is what our community is expecting us, and that's what they need from us. If it's so you know, if you look on page 5, those are some of the priority bills that we worked on. In education, Violeta Hernandez worked on the Increasing Teachers of Color Act, which several provisions passed. And I'm proud to say that it wasn't just a council, it was a joint effort from our councils that were working, along with coalitions that several folks from across the state that also want to see this. I think anybody that looks at the numbers and says, well, we have 94% of the teachers are white, but over 30% of our students are of color. I'm not saying that we need to have 30+% teachers of color. I'm just saying let's meet somewhere where everybody benefits, including every single person in Minnesota will benefit from having more diverse teachers in their schools. In health, we worked on the spoken language healthcare interpreters registry system. Economic development, we worked on wage staff, and we're happy that some of that work went through last year and received over $1 million towards employing folks to make sure that they investigate wage staff that impacts our community, and not just the Latino community. It impacts all Minnesotans, and this should be something that we should be addressing, but doing it in a way where we don't hurt businesses either. So that we're proud to say that that's a bill that managed to do both. And again, immigration, I can tell you I can't wait for the day I don't need to talk about immigration anymore. I can tell you that much. Immigration is the most important thing in our community right now. And I would be lying to you if I said I personally didn't care. It impacts every single person on my staff personally, every single person on my board personally, and it's a very emotional topic. But I can't wait till the day that the federal government is able to move past something so it doesn't come down to the state level and we're having to address different things. But I can tell you that we do expect and would like your support in addressing some things. And I understand that that could be considered piecemeal, but our community is here. Out of the 300,000 Latinos that are here right now, over 50% of them are under the age of 25. Over 90% of them are native-born. So the people that you're really impacting is the future of Latinos in the state of Minnesota. And the way I like to talk about the future of Latinos or Latinos in Minnesota is by calling them Minnesotanos, which means the Spanish word for Minnesotans. So if it's impacting a person in Minnesota, it's impacting all of us. And that's how we would like to have this conversation, respectfully, emotionally, if you let me do it. But I think we can do something together, and we would love to respectfully provide you with ideas of what, no matter who's in control, what we can do together as a state. if you continue on, you'll see some of the pictures of us. Like, we will meet you wherever you want me to meet you. I mean, if you allow me to have 2 minutes of your time, if my staff can have 2 minutes of your time, we will walk you to wherever, to your car, to wherever you want. But we've been lucky that this year we have been given a lot more time from you. We had a coffee and donuts event a few weeks ago, and honestly, we weren't sure what to expect, and we were really happy to see that over 30, 40 legislators and or their staff showed up, and they wanted to hear about these reports. They wanted to hear about our community, and I hope that you see that our intention is to provide you the best information that you can trust. Because what I tell you, Mr. Chair, is the same thing I will tell any person that is not in this committee or in any community events. It doesn't matter what party they're from or what organization they're from. Their message will always be the same. We want to be a trusted source of information. And I think we're there. Are we there, team? Yeah, thumbs up. Expectations and standards moving forward. I think one thing that people kind of forget what they're doing if they don't put it in place, what they're supposed to do in the future. And I could tell you that after 2 years of doing the Minnesotanos Day at the Capitol, that is an expectation not just of us, but of our community, for us to organize a day at the Capitol so that we can organize several meetings with you all. This year we had over 30 meetings scheduled. The year before, similar. I would love for that number to keep increasing to hopefully one day we could just say all 201 of you have a meeting scheduled with Minnesotanos. There's an expectation of legislative recaps. Folks need to know what we worked on. They might agree or disagree with us. We're aware of that. There's always a minority opinion in every group. They need to know what we're doing as well. Visit our communities outside the metro area, which I'll tell you a little bit more in our community engagement report. In-house research, some of the graphs that you're seeing here, we created, we want to do more for you. Reports and presentations to our community and to you. Leadership meetings with our community. The legislative and policy leaders, and we also believe that our community should know what we're going to work on in the future before the legislative session starts. So having that in place before.
I just wanted to add one thing, if I may, Mr. Chair. Henry was referring to the Minnesotanos Day at the Capitol, and I'm hearing you ask some questions about how the councils are supporting community. So I just wanted to offer that as a proactive example. Last year I attended, and I was the closing speaker, and what I saw was some schools were bringing their students as field trips to Minnesotanos Day at the Capitol. Last year I saw elementary school students doing so. This year I saw high school students doing so. And the legislative meetings that the staff set up were attended by those students. And for many of them, this was the first time they or anybody in their family had ever even come into the Capitol. When I came to Minnesota, 3 years after I got here, I did a fellowship with the Wilder Foundation. They sent me into the Capitol. It was the first time I ever stepped into the building. I'm the daughter of Mexican immigrants, and neither one of my parents was able to achieve more than an elementary school education. It was an incredibly powerful moment. And to know that our council is able to collaborate with community to expose them to the process and to engage them and to say, this place serves you too, is incredibly powerful.
Thank you, Angelica. Now I want to bring your attention to this report. This is our community engagement report. There's a reason why this one feels heavier than our other report. I spent a lot of time on this. I think that if we're going to provide you information about communities, we should always be in tune and communicating with our communities. And we felt that we needed to also do more in greater Minnesota, not just in the metro area. We chose seven locations, such as Wilmer, Worthington, St. James, and those were chosen because of the demographics or the population density of Latinos there. We wanted to listen to them. We wanted to provide information on MCLA, but we also wanted to share with our community about the work that we're doing, and we were able to develop a 3 minutes, all right. We developed a guide to be able to, so that we didn't just show up and say, tell us what your barriers are. We spent a good amount of time coming up with a guide that can be utilized in the future by whoever's in place, so that we begin to have institutional memory here. We returned to these locations because we wanted to validate what we heard from folks. And I was surprised to see even more people at the second meeting because they were like, so I think they were even surprised that we came back, that it wasn't just a drive-by, that we are actually establishing genuine relationships with these community members. And as you can see, they grabbed our recommendations, and some of them said, nope, this is not what we said, or it's not what I thought we, and we made sure that the final product was what they told us in the first place. And again, we believe in intersectionality. Those are our four areas of focus. After months, last summer, we came up with this report. As you can see, it's huge. I just want to bring your attention, just because of time, to page four. If you're going to read 3 pages, read the 4 to 6. This is executive summary where it tells you what were the recommendations in those specific areas of focus. And there's no surprise that our one pager, Representative Driscoll, or one-pager resembles that. This is what I feel that is, I'm very proud of this because I feel like it's a, you know, sorry, I'm spacing out here. Genuinely provided to us. This is genuine community engagement. It's hard, but now I can say that the state of Minnesota is genuinely engaging the Latino community, at least in those seven communities, and I can tell you there will be more communities this summer. And actually, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it. So, this report already, maybe I'll finish this here. We then brought this report, put together the legislative agenda or priorities. This, I don't know if you can tell, but there's over 100 people there. There's people in a separate room. This is us presenting a report and a legislative agenda. I never thought that we would get this many people who would be interested in confirming and saying, yes, this is what we told you, and that is what you should be doing at the Capitol for us. This is, I think, very powerful. This is the state of Minnesota doing this. This is us. with that said, I also want to bring attention to the both reports. This report, we received after we put it out, the Blandon Foundation had an interest. They're paying for us to be able to print this. It's not coming from public dollars to print this. I know you like this. No. And we're able to go back to those communities and even have a little bit of a small event that is going to be paid because of those funds. We also received a grant from the Minnesota Comeback to be able to work on our Teachers of Color Act work. And because of that, we were able to have additional funds to pay our fellows, because we do believe that the type of work that they're doing is high quality work and they should be paid for it. And that's where I'm at. I guess thank you. Gracias for your time. I'm maybe next time I can go first. I was really prepared, so let's just say that I had to deliver it, and half the time I thought I was happy. But not complaining, just happy to be here.
Thank you, Director Jimenez. We do have some member questions. And first we had that question about ombudsman from Representative Quam. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Representative Quam, you know, our agency by statute has to be in dozens of task forces or committees, just like you do. The ombudsperson is one that I personally meet with multiple times a year. She attends our events. I make her known of the things that we're working on, because I've never had to replace that individual, so I've never gone through that process. But I hope I don't ever have to, because we're developing that relationship to make sure that she addresses what it is in statute, and we've gone over that, what she is supposed to do and what I'm supposed to do. And when that time comes, then our chair will be involved in the replacement process, because that's what's in statute. I'm not a lawyer, but I read our statutes a lot.
Thank you. We have two members with questions. If we can keep them brief, and then we will adjourn. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's more of a comment. I just want to say thank you all to the councils for being here to advocate for all of our communities here in the state of Minnesota. And do want to say thank you to the Latino Council for providing this one pager with the demographics for our district. I think that this is greatly needed, and if the other councils could do the same, I think that would be great too. And I just want to say I can attest to the council's effort in reaching out to all of our members. I've been personally asked, you know, or pulled aside in the hallways or in the cafeteria, and been invited to travel the state of Minnesota to even contribute to the rural report too. And so I really appreciate that too. And then just one quick comment about the importance of data disaggregation that we have too here. If you look at the graph that they have shown here, where under Asian Americans are the highest with regards to the median income, but article from the Pie Press back in 2016 have said that Hmong refugees specifically are living near or at poverty compared to our Asian Indians, who are some of our highest earners too. And so this is just showing why it is so important for us to have data disaggregation in the state of Minnesota. I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward too.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I noticed in your report it says there's under education, it says there's a shortage of Latino, bilingual, or cross-culturally competent educators in Minnesota schools. I'm just wondering if in your outreach, I know there's a lot of Spanish immersion schools in Minnesota. I know because my daughter goes to one. She'll occasionally start speaking Spanish, and I have no idea what she's saying, and I'm terrified for the day when her brother will be going there too, and they'll be able to say things to each other, and neither of her parents will know what they're saying. But that's kind of a side issue. I'm just wondering, I mean, I know, like, you know, for the most part, they're elementary schools. That's a little young to be thinking about career opportunities and such, but it does seem like there's a possibility of, you know, of your council doing some outreach to those schools. Just wondering if that's something you've done or are interested in doing.
Yeah, well, I could tell you that I'll give you an example. When we visited Long Prairie Gray Elementary is where we had our Gray Eagle Elementary is where we had our listening session, and we met when we didn't just meet with community members. We met with superintendents, principals, police chiefs, leadership, mayors. When I asked what was the population of Latino students at that school, it was about 50%. I was like, wow, that's awesome. That's the future of that community. Mm-hmm. When I asked how many teachers are Latino or bilingual, how many do you think were there?
I'll say 5%.
5%. 2%.
Two people.
I would say if we could get to that 5%, we're on the right track. Unfortunately, there's not even two people. There was one. And so that is what's happening in some of the communities. And again, we're not here to blame anybody. We just want to provide ideas of how can we get to that place of how do we provide that support to those principals to either recruit or grow their own within to be able to be bilingual, or eventually some of those students are going to be the teachers, I would hope. And we want to make sure that we have the things in place so that they do become teachers. I just want to plug one more thing in. I didn't get to talk about this because under immigration, but, you know, DED was brought up. One thing that impacts the Latino community even more is that TPS, you know, temporary protection status. Just to give you an example, there's over 1,000 Salvadorians that live in the state of Minnesota and lived here through legal status for over 20 years. I met with several business owners, some that have provided jobs to over 45 people. These businesses are huge. If they go, what happens to that community? And they're not just hiring Latinos, they're hiring folks from that community. So I would love to have your support in something like that as well, not to get at the federal level. And the last thing I would like to say is the energy and the competence of our councils at this point, I think, it's never been like this. I think we're at a great place right now. My colleagues are some of the smartest people I've ever met. My team are smarter than I am. So I would like to end by saying that there's a bunch of folks in the audience. If you missed this, I would like to get an applause for the ethnic councils today as loud as you can.
and members, with that, I would like to, on behalf of the committee, thank all of the councils for being here today. And I think your message is getting out because we've got people coming from the highways and the byways here at the end of our meeting. So with that, we are